For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. My special guest today is someone I've been wanting to catch up with for a long time. Dr. Yumiko Kadota was in her eighth year of postgraduate work as a plastics registrar, chasing her surgery dream when her world fell apart. She had been working at Bankstown Hospital in Sydney as an unaccredited registrar as she tried to get on the surgery training program. After 24 straight days working, including 19 days on 24/7 on-call duty, Yumiko's body made the decision for her and began shutting down from exhaustion. On the 1st of June 2018, she resigned after interventions from six senior doctors failed to improve her working conditions. Shortly after, she wrote a blog post called "The Ugly Side of Becoming a Surgeon," which went viral. In the 2.5 years since, Yumiko is recovering mentally and physically and is finding contentment and balance in her new life. Welcome to the podcast, Yumiko. Congratulations on the book.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much.
Yeah, I finished reading it a couple of days ago, actually. Has it helped you writing it?
I think yes and no. I think the thing that's helped me the most is actually hearing from other people saying, hey, I went through that too, so it's validating. But the process of writing it was quite distressing, so it probably wasn't the best thing for me to do.
It dug up a lot, I suppose.
It did bring up a lot, but I knew that it was something important and something that I wanted to do. So
watching the conversation on Twitter just the last few days about visiting hospitals where she'd felt she'd been traumatized.
It's full That's on amazing. Reading stuff like that from people who have actually gone through and finished. And you know, there were a couple of doctors, not even in surgery, saying that they can't pick up the book because they don't think they could read it.
Yeah. I get that, yeah. I mean, it was easy to read in the sense that I couldn't put it down, but it's certainly not easy content, is it? I mean, it's very confronting. First of all, filming in on what's happened. When you finished the book, you were teaching, you were doing some clinical work in the private sector. Yes. What have the last 18 months or so been like for you in terms of COVID and what you're doing now?
Yeah, I'm pretty much the same, still involved at the university in anatomy and also doing some private assisting. So that's been a bit more of a recent thing. So it's nice to be able to do some clinical work again. Obviously, private assisting is not nearly as rewarding as working in the public hospital and finishing a training program, but it suits me okay because I'm able to have a bit more, I guess I can set boundaries a bit better when I'm doing private because I can see what days I'm available and what days I'm not, and have days set aside for when I need to have like a psychology appointment or do some exercise or do something that I need to do for myself because I'm still, you know, I'm still on medication, I'm still recovering, so I'm still taking it easy even though I'm so much better than I was a few years ago. But yeah, COVID did affect me in that I was unemployed for a few months because the campus
the uni shut down pretty much, didn't it?
Yeah.
The medication stuff, does it bother you still being on medication?
Doesn't bother me in that if that's what I need to function, then that's what I need. And I've kind of accepted that. And, you know, I'm very sensitive to medication changes. So my psych doesn't want me to come off it too soon. I think it's a, you know, it is an aim in the future to be able to wean off it and be medication free again. But I've accepted that if it doesn't work and I need to stay on it, then I'll stay on it because it's helping me function. And it's allowing me to do what I need to do each day. So I've really come to accept it because initially I didn't even want to accept my diagnosis. So,
I can understand that. It's hard to know where to start because there's so many issues that, that happened for you while you were training. There was a racism element going on. There was the sexism, obviously, that goes on in particularly in surgery, but in all training. At some point in the book, you say no good ever came out of whistleblowing. Mm. Do you feel like a whistleblower?
Yeah, I do a little bit. I mean, I think more commonly whistleblowers are still in the system, so they have a lot more to lose. But for me, I felt like I had nothing to lose in that I'd already chosen to leave, so it was a lot easier for me than for other people. But in the same sense that I called out unacceptable behaviour, in that sense I do feel like a bit of a whistleblower.
Are you happy?
Yeah, I'm happy, yeah.
Good. Excellent.
Do you mean like in general or about what I've done?
Yeah, about life in general. But I mean, surgery was such a huge focus for you and always was, particularly plastics. Yeah. Do you miss it? Do you regret not getting through that program or do you feel like it was just un-get-throughable?
I definitely miss it. I won't lie. There are times when I still think about hand surgery and you know, how much I enjoyed doing K-wiring. I know it's so oddly specific, but that was the procedure I really enjoyed doing. I liked that you had to work really hard to be accurate and fast at doing it. So I really enjoyed doing hand trauma, of all things. That was my thing that I really enjoyed. So I do definitely still think about it sometimes. But when I think about the sacrifices you have to make to get there and the cost of getting there emotionally, for me, I just think I made the right decision and I've accepted it. I mean, I'm grateful now that I'm still able to do some clinical work. I am still in plastics in that I'm private assisting to plastic surgeons who are lovely and I go with them to all of their lists. So in some ways I'm a little bit greedy in that I get to do the fun bits. I get to be in the operating theater without having to do anything else. I turn up, I assist, I go home. So it's nice. It's a very nice arrangement. Certainly not as rewarding, but I'm still grateful that I can do a little bit of clinical work.
What was the tipping point for you? You were working 24 days straight. Your body was giving up on you, really, wasn't it? You were that exhausted. Can you pinpoint a particular point where you just went, I'm done?
There are two big moments, I think, during that term. I think that I was able to cope with stress and long hours for several years. I mean, at that stage, it was my eighth year of working, so it was nothing new, working hard. But that was the first time where I felt like my physical health was deteriorating, and I'd never experienced that before. And it was during the car ride to work when I lost fecal continence that it told me something was really seriously wrong.
Absolutely.
Sometimes something like that has to happen before you kind of face the music. I just thought, wow, that's not normal. I'm a healthy person. I shouldn't be losing my continence. Like, that is not, something's wrong. Something is wrong.
Did you know immediately what the problem was in terms of, did you know it was stress, or did you think, oh my God, I've got some weird bowel cancer type effort going on?
Yeah, because I guess doctors like to diagnose themselves and they might have all the different causes of like fecal or, you know, bowel problems. But I knew straight away, I just knew in my heart that it was due to stress. I guess the medical part of me kind of knows the side effects of chronic stress. And I think that it was leading up to that point, you know, I there was no question that it was that.
What was the other tipping point? You said there were two big moments.
The other point was when I got the updated roster for the remainder of term. I mean, at that point, so many people had spoken up on my behalf, including my GP, the head of surgery even. And I thought, wow, if the head of surgery can't even get my department to make changes, what hope is there of anything ever changing?
Yeah.
That roster showed that I'd be working even more hours in the second half of term because I'd be covering leave for my two colleagues, the ENT registrar and the other plastics registrar. So I thought, actually, it's not going to get better. It's going to get worse. And that's when I thought, I can't do it anymore. I'm already pushed to my limit and it's only going to get worse. Those were the two major points for me.
Wow. Looking back on your story, I mean, I've made some notes here. I mean, there were incidents all the way through the doctor who assaulted you, essentially, and who went to jail later on, thank goodness. Everything sort of just piled up. Do you feel like your experience was unusual? Was it something about you, do you think, or were other people, I mean, you talk about other registrars who were having bad experiences, the one who got knocked off an operation and that she could do but that you were asked to do. Do you feel like you had it worse, or do you feel like this is just normal for people going through this training program?
I don't think my experience was unique at all, especially now having spoken to so many other women, particularly in surgery. I feel that even though all the incidents might not be exactly the same, I think we've gone through a very similar experience. So
yeah,
I feel like by sharing stories, we're able to validate each other's experiences and realize that it's not just the individual. And that's something that was really important for me to do, because I feel like some doctors and hospitals gaslight their employees, and you're made to feel like you're the one with the problem. And so when you go through this kind of thing, you blame yourself, thinking, what did I do wrong? And of course, there was self-reflection on my part when things started to go wrong, thinking about what I possibly could have done better. But I think the more I talk to others, the more I realize that there are some common themes running, not just in surgery, but in other areas of medicine as well. And I don't want it to turn into the oppression Olympics where we kind of fight about who's the most marginalized, you know, who I'm black, so I have it worse, or I'm a woman, or I'm LGBTQIA. There's so many different ways in which people get discriminated. And I don't think that it should be a competition of who gets it worse. So I'm certainly not saying that I've had the worst experience ever. And I'm sure there are people who have had it worse than me. But I guess it's about addressing some of the common things that are happening and think about how we can change it. I mean, I couldn't even begin to explore what it's like for doctors with disabilities or doctors who, you know, queer doctors. And that's a limitation of my book in that I can only speak for myself and what I've experienced, but I'm sure there are other ways in which people have felt like they were treated differently while training as a doctor.
What kind of feedback have you had from colleges, universities, hospitals? Have you had any since the book came out or since your blog, you know, when you first sort of said this was going on? What kind of feedback have you had?
It's mainly been positive, and I recently did hear from my university because I did write about being sexually assaulted by a professor. Mm-hmm. And so I did receive an apology for that happening and them not supporting me more at the time. Mm-hmm. And I think especially now with what's happening in other areas like politics, I think it's so important for women to feel like they can come forward and not fear repercussions or fear not being believed. And that was certainly a fear of mine at the time. And, you know, as a 19-year-old girl, you don't have the courage to speak up because you're still so young. I was still a student. I haven't even finished medical school yet. And so I think it's really important for universities to take this seriously. So it's not just hospitals. I think that it starts at the university stage that we address some of what's happening.
I'm chatting today with Dr. Yumiko Kadota, whose new book called Emotional Woman is now available from all good booksellers. If there are people in the medical professions who you would like to hear from, drop us a line. You can reach me by email at cswannell, that's C, S for Sam, W-A-N-N-E-L-L at mja.com.au. Meanwhile, there is a new issue of the MJA out today at mja.com.au. And there's a new edition of Insight Plus, our weekly online news magazine, at Insight Plus, that's insightplus.mja.com.au. Back to our chat with Yumiko. Anything from the College of Surgeons?
No. I am aware that they did send around an email after the blog post. Friends of mine who are trainees did forward me that email to show that they had kind of responded to it. And
but nothing to you personally?
Yeah, there were members of, you know, the College of Surgeons who offered to pay for counselling, but I just I don't think counselling is going to help me now. I've gone through, you know, psychiatric treatment. I've gone through a lot more than just a little bit of counselling to fix
exactly.
problem. So
plus it doesn't give you your career back, does it?
No, exactly. So there were little things like that I heard from individual people, but not directly from the College of Surgeons itself. But I have been approached from the other colleges to share my experiences and talk at various meetings and things. So I think it is something that the colleges do care about. They do want to make it better for their trainees. But I guess the thing here is, how about the unaccredited people who aren't in a college? I think that's been quite a big discussion in the last few years. In that,
are you seeing any improvement in that in their situation?
I haven't yet. No one seems to be answering the question of who looks after unaccredited registrars. It's kind of an in-between position in that the postgraduate medical councils are looking after PGY 1 and 2, and the accredited trainees are looked after by the colleges, but no one knows who's looking after the unaccredited registrars in the middle. And I think that that's still going to be an ongoing issue until we have one body, even if it's a new one, there needs to be somebody who looks after that very vulnerable group of doctors, because when you're not yet selected onto a training program, you're very vulnerable to exploitation.
The students you teach now, are they aware of who you are and what you went through, and do they talk to you about it?
Yeah, I'm a very open person, and the students have asked me directly about it. At the end of anatomy class, sometimes they'll be very shy and say, "No, excuse me, are you that doctor who wrote that blog?" So, I have had students ask me about it, and I've always been open about talking to them about it. And I've always felt like I don't want to discourage any students from going for their dreams. If they want to do it, then I fully support them doing it. I don't see my job as protecting students and telling them not to do it. I see my role as just increasing awareness that there will be challenges, and to know that it can happen and potential ways to deal with it, rather than saying don't do it.
Do you feel like students are far more aware now of what they're getting themselves into?
I think so. And even seeing the kind of groups that are at uni, I feel encouraged that students are very proactive about these issues. At the uni I'm teaching at, for example, there's a well-being group that is run by both the medical society as well as the faculty of medicine. So it's a very collaborative approach to think of strategies to look after student well-being. So I do feel that there's a big change like that from the early stages. The well-being groups didn't exist when I was at uni, and I've even seen, a queer group in medicine as well. And that's something I never thought I would see. I have friends who are queer, and one of my friends is gay, and he was in the closet the whole time we were at uni. He just felt like he couldn't be himself because he was afraid of judgment. So to see things like that is really heartwarming, to know that we are trying to be more inclusive. And so seeing the queer group and seeing the well-being group for me were two things that I feel really positively about.
They're up for the fight. And I think that's what we're seeing too with the Brittany Higgins thing. Canberra thing is great. Just young women.
It's amazing. And Chanel Contos, who's so young. And, you know, it's just horrifying that high school students are going through this. But I think it's such an important conversation to talk about consent and sexual assault, and for young women to feel like they can speak up and that they can stick up for themselves for unacceptable behaviors. So we're seeing a real movement now in all areas, not just in medicine, where we're trying to stop these unacceptable behaviors from happening.
One of the things that has always amazed me that in medicine is that sometimes the worst abusers are the ones who were the worst abused when they went through training, that it becomes like, this is what you have to go through in order to become a great doctor. Do you still see that cycle happening?
I see that so much. It's almost like intergenerational trauma. You're just kind of perpetuating that same cycle, and we need to break that cycle. But I mean, I completely understand why it happens. If you've gone through something traumatic yourself, sometimes it's not even a conscious thing that you're doing the same thing to others. But I think it takes a really big person to say, you know what, I went through a terrible time, but I don't want my junior colleagues to suffer through the same thing, so I am going to change it. So I think we do need senior surgeons and physicians to really be the ones who change that. We talk a lot about the younger generation, and I see so much hope when I look at the younger generations, but we do need the people who have suffered in the past to say, I suffered, but I can stop it. They're the ones in the position of power at the moment. It's the consultants who can really drive that change, because they're at the top. And, you know, people say the fish rots from the head. So we really need better institutional leadership and not just rely on the people at the bottom to make change. I think it goes both ways.
One of the things that really struck me reading your book was how good you are with patients and how good you are with the juniors that you were supervising. Does that ability, do you think, should that have shaped the way your career went, do you think? Or was, in other words, I guess what I'm saying is you were so obviously great at relating to people that if perhaps you'd gone the way of a general practitioner or a psychologist or a psychiatrist, do you feel like those skills were not best suited to the pathway that you took?
Thank you for saying that. I do see how, you know, my communication skills would have been useful in other areas, but we do need empathetic surgeons, you know.
Yeah.
Even though a lot of the work is mechanical and you have to be good with your hands, I think that if anything, you have to be even more empathetic as a surgeon, because it's a pretty scary thing to go under a general anesthetic. And there's a lot of anxiety before surgery, and you need someone who is able to talk to you in a kind way, to explain things to you. It's very stressful. And surgery, you know, in surgery, you do deal with lots of terrible traumas and cancers and things that do require a lot of care and empathy. Even though I'm sure that, you know, communication skills are transferable to other areas of medicine, I feel like in surgery it's really important as well. And I don't want people to think that surgery is just about the mechanics of things and drive people who are empathetic away and into areas like psychology or psychiatry, like you mentioned, because we do need more heart in surgery, I think.
If you had your way, if you had a magic wand, Yumiko, would you choose medical students differently than we currently do?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, there is no perfect selection process. I acknowledge that. And I don't think the problem is at the medical student level. I think now it's quite a well-rounded process in that, you know, there are interviews and that test does test things like emotional intelligence as well. So I'm glad that it's not simply based on marks like it was a long time ago. So I think that the selection for medical students is, I think, quite good. And there are rural access schemes as well to help people who, are a bit more marginalized geographically, and Aboriginal scholarships and things. So I do know that there are ways that we're trying to increase diversity in med school. I think it's more as we progress that selection is more of a problem, because there are fewer positions for people. And when we think about the lack of visibility of surgeons in Australia, I think that perhaps we do need to start thinking about quotas. If you look at it, is controversial, and I do know that a lot of people say targets are better than quotas, but it's taken such a long time and not much of an increase. So maybe we do need to introduce it. I mean, at the moment, only 11% of surgeons are women. That is such a small number, and it's even smaller in areas like orthopedics, which I believe is 4%.
Worse than Parliament.
It is. It's and when I look at all these corporate groups talking about a 30% target, I think, wow, that's really good. But I think that, you know, part of the problem with misogyny is that the lack of visibility. If there aren't enough women around to say, hey, that's not cool what you just said, or you know, or even role modeling and seeing other women or other people who look like you in surgery, it does affect the experience of women. So I don't know what it takes to get the numbers higher. I do know that culturally we need to change to make it more welcoming for women. For example, the AOA doing the Orthopaedic Women's Link and running all these wonderful workshops to encourage young women to enter orthopaedics. And I think that these strategies are really great. But cultural shift takes so long, and I just don't know whether things are changing fast enough. I just feel like we're still 10, 20 years away from seeing a real big shift. And as we've spoken about before, all the young people now, all the young medical students becoming consultants will take another 10, 20 years. So I'm thinking to myself, when they become consultants, maybe things will be better. But that's still a long time away. It's still a long time for things to happen badly. So, I mean, there's so many strategies, and I'm not going to pretend that I know all the answers, but I feel like one way to improve things would be to increase the diversity, not just with the gender, but also ethnically as well, and other ways.
What are your personal ambitions now? Where do you see yourself in 5 years? What do you want to be doing?
Gosh, no one's really asked me that recently. So much has changed in the last couple of years, and I feel like I'm constantly doing new things now. But I feel pretty stable in what I'm doing now. I'm very happy working part-time as a surgical assistant and doing a bit of teaching here, doing a bit of yoga. I've even started teaching body pump. So
excellent.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun, and I'm glad that I'm able to lead a life now where I feel balanced. I know that it comes from a place of privilege in that, you know, if you've got an education, it allows you to do lots of different things. And I know that it's not always easy for others to just quit and then find something else to do. And there were periods of time where I was unemployed and worried about what was going to happen. But now I feel thankful that I've been able to find lots of new hobbies as well as reconnecting with old hobbies to lead a life now where I feel content.
Good. Thank you, Yumiko. I really appreciate your time. And congratulations on the book. It's a terrific read. Not easy, but a terrific read. And I hope things change.
I hope so too.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.